Hello and welcome to season 3 of Mum's Work and Chaos. We all know the saying, it takes a village to raise a child, but where is that village? Well, I started this podcast to help you find yours, and I'm joined by some amazing guests this season, talking about subjects such as fast fashion, menopause, sex education, and teenage behaviour, just to name a few. So join me this season, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to this episode of Mum's Work and Chaos. Today we're talking teenage behaviour. Nothing is off the table when it comes to this subject. We've had so many of you write in and ask your questions. And today I'm joined by the wonderful Emily Hughes from Finding Flow Parenting, who, you know, is just a behaviour savant. So Emily, if you could introduce yourself, tell us a bit more about you, what you do, and why you understand teenagers.
Yeah, so I spent 10 years as a secondary school teacher with teenagers every day for 10 years.
Bless you. Like
13 to 19 every day. You know, and when you're a teacher, it's like you're in the classroom, you're way more contact with teenagers than you do with other adults. So it's a full immersion in teenagers. And I am a conscious parenting coach now, so I've left teaching. And I help parents to find more ease and flow in family life and help them get unstuck, because I'm sure a lot of you listeners are aware that that really is a word. We can get stuck. We can get stuck in patterns of behavior. We can get stuck in conflict. We can get stuck in disconnection. And I really help parents to get unstuck and find a new pathway forward, really based on deep connection to themselves and to their children. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, last time we spoke about anger specifically, and it wasn't just, we spoke about being angry as a parent and how we can use that to identify those key issues that need to be worked on as well, which is amazing and did actually really help me, because I think my go-to once I've got to that overstimulated, overwhelmed place is just that. You feel angry, and then you feel angry at yourself because you popped off, and and it's hard to break that cycle. And so, you know, this conscious method and recognizing those actions and reactions, you know, is just, I think it's fantastic and a great way of actually becoming more aware of yourself and what you can do. So brilliant. So as I said, a lot of you sent questions in. This was a subject that that really hit a nerve with some of you. But I think really, like, the first one is basically around communication. So as a parent of young children, I don't have teenagers yet, but I will do, so this is going to help me. I find it difficult to get my 7-year-old to communicate with me as soon as she gets out of school. I have to let her decompress a bit and then I can ask her the questions. But a lot of parents sent in messages saying, how do I get my child to actually speak English? Or how do I get them to communicate in something other than grunts and noises? It's difficult, isn't it? They're going through this whole like extra processing part of their, you know, their brain's developing at such a rate once they become a teenager as well, so they sort of just fall into this trap of grunts and moans to get by, don't they?
I think you've really hit on something there, which is about the brain development, right? And I think the most powerful thing a parent of a teenager can do is pause this podcast. Come back to it though. Google teenagers' brain development. Because sometimes what is happening, as you rightly said, teenagers are going through this phase of enormous brain development. And it's a normal and natural process. But sometimes what's happening is we are expecting our teenagers to be able to respond in maybe the way they either used to respond and they were younger, or in the way that an adult would respond. And it's almost like when you start reading about what are normal behaviors based on the brain development of teenagers, we can show up a little bit differently. And actually, that kind of grunting and not wanting to communicate, you know, there's reasons for that kind of based in child development, you know, that help explain that. And I think when we are able to view it in that way, we can get less emotionally sort of, because it can feel a bit like rejection, and it can feel a bit like, oh, where's my sweet child gone, and they're now just communicating in these grunts. And when we're in that and it feels like rejection, we're not going to be able to show up for our child in a way that we would really want to, and because we can get lost in that emotion. So I think a really important part of it is being aware of the brain development of children and teenagers, and you know what is normal. Because I think some of you might be aware of this. It was in the news last year about this study from Stanford University about how teenagers' brains find their mother's voice less rewarding than when they were children. And just like that makes sense kind of developmentally.
Oh my gosh.
Because a teenager, you know, is meant to go through a rites of passage into adulthood. And in order to go through that rites of passage, they need to separate a bit from the parents. But crucially, they don't want to separate forever. They need to be returning. So it's this separating and returning process. And if they were able to, if they were listening and hanging off every word we said, that would actually not serve them in their journey to adulthood, right? Because they need to be going out into the world and then returning, going out into the world and then
getting more and more independent.
But I think crucially, and one of the things I really wanted to talk about in this is about attachment and peer attachment. And I think this can really come up in that communication thing as well. So this is this idea from psychologist Gordon Neufeld. And it's from a really lovely book I would totally recommend. It's called Hold On to Your Kids. And so what he says is that peer attachment is when a child's moral compass, the center of their world, is their friends and not their parents. And the problem with children who are peer attached rather than family attached is that they don't listen very well to adults. And when I see it so clearly now, looking back on when I was a secondary school teacher and seeing the kids who were peer attached versus family attached, right, as their primary source of attachment and connection. Yeah. And the thing is the ones who are peer attached, it was much, much harder to teach them. And they were the ones who'd be like eye-rolling their parents at parents' evening.
Yeah.
Because the center of their world is their friends and not the family. But I think people misunderstand this a little bit, because it's not that like a child who's attached to the family just stays with the family all the time. They need to go through that process of going out into the world, but then their safe harbor, that place where they can return to, is the family, is the home.
Yeah. That's amazing. So yeah, it's really tricky though, isn't it? Like, you know, I know I've watched tons of videos about how to get information out of her when she's come out of school, and like the questions to ask, and instead of saying, you know, like, what did you do, because they've done so much they can never remember, and so they go, nothing. What did you eat? Don't know. We ask things like, oh, what was your favorite part of the day, because they're always going to remember that. What was the worst bit of the day? What you know, what part of the day could have been better? Or, you know, did you enjoy your lunch? And then they suddenly remember what it was, because they're remembering whether they enjoyed it or not. You're not asking them what it was. And so I found those sorts of things work quite well. But yeah, like this, yeah, the grunts, they just grunt, don't they? And it's like actually getting them to communicate and talk to you. I think it's really funny though as well that you mentioned that the mother's voice becomes less rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when I look at some of my nieces and nephews who are teenagers now, which is quite scary, you see that as well, don't you? They might listen less, or they're less inclined to do something that's mm-hmm. helpful or a favor or something for mum, because I didn't even realize that could have been a possibility. It's quite insane.
And part of it is, it's a really natural process where a child is like developing their own autonomy and sense of self in those teenage years. And this thing around control and trust, I think, is such a like interesting dynamic, in that children in general, but especially teenagers, resist control and being controlled. And that's actually a really normal and healthy thing, because if you imagine if a teenager were easily controlled, it would be easy for the parents, but it would actually be dangerous for the child, because that child could be controlled by anyone. They could be easily exploited. So a helpful reframe, if your teenager's resisting being controlled, is that actually, you know, that's going to serve them well out in the wider world. Because if a child is not able to say no, then that's, you know, potentially going to put them in some tricky situations. So I think sometimes it's about, yes, it's not convenient for the parent to experience some of these teen behaviors, but actually looking at it expansively, like, how will this serve them in like an expansive view of the whole of their life, even though it's very tricky as a parent to have a child who's not obeying. It's very tricky.
Would you say that the, now I'm gonna say the word rebellious, reaction to control, would you say that, you know, a child who was probably feeling more controlled than another one might exhibit more what could be seen as disrespectful behavior towards their parents? Do you think those two things sort of go hand in hand? The more control that is exerted over the child, the more disrespectful or rebellious they might be.
I think I was watching the other day on Netflix, I can't remember what it's called, but it's about the At Home with the Furies, is it? It's about the and about his family. And I thought, this is from the words of his teenage daughter. She said, strict parents create sneaky kids. And that's from the words of a 15-year-old. I thought that was really interesting. I think, you know, something to think about here. The book, The Happiest Kids in the World, which is about Dutch parenting, there is a chapter in that, whether this be true or not, I'm not sure, any Dutch listeners can comment, Dutch teenagers don't rebel. That was the title of the chapter. Now, that's probably a bit of a generalization and a stereotyping, but I think there's a little piece in the way that the focus of the chapter was, which is about trust. And teenagers who feel they have a seat at the table, who feel trusted, who are engaging in problem solving, and who are actively engaged with their parents through trusting dialogue, I think they're less likely to rebel, because there is less to rebel against. And I think it's really interesting thinking about being curious. So I like this phrase. I just came up with it, by the way. I think whenever there's like an issue with your teenager, instead of doubling down on control, turn up the AC. Okay, so AC, obviously it's air conditioning, but AC, acceptance
Yeah.
Curiosity. Or it could be acceptance and connection. The acceptance piece, I think, goes back to what we were talking about before. Acceptance of the fact that your child, their brain is not fully formed yet. Your
Yeah.
teenage brain is not fully formed. And it won't be fully formed until they are 25. Because adolescence, actually, you know, that's the age that it ends, is
No,
25.
crazy, isn't it?
So if we're expecting our child to have the same brain as us, we're setting ourselves up for failure because the teenage brain is not yet fully formed. And you know, within that is things like teenagers' risk appraisal. It's a really interesting one. Apparently, teenagers are their brains are capable of assessing risk, but yet they're willing to go through the risk if the outcome seems good.
Yeah, I
And
get
you know, that's
that.
just the thing, how their brains are different to us. So there's some, you know, the way forward, I think, turn up the AC, the first one, acceptance. Accept that your child's brain is different to your brain, right? Secondly, is approach with curiosity. She's like, that's an interesting choice you've made. Can you tell me more about that? And just listening, because teenagers deeply, deeply need to be listened to. But often what gets in the way of parents listening to teenagers is fear.
Yeah.
Because I think it's such a scary time when you see your child going out into the world away from you more, like going and doing things. And, you know, what comes into this is the teenage brain, you know, they're primed for risk.
Yeah, so you've literally, I mean, when you think about it, if your brain isn't fully developed until you're 25, you're sending your child off to university at the age of 18 with a still undeveloped brain,
Yeah.
and fend for themselves and hope for the best in a place full of alcohol. I'm only kidding. It's fine. I've done it. It was good. I survived. But it can be a scary prospect. And I suppose from a parental point of view, that leads you to then wanting to keep them closer, maybe be more in control of the situation because you're losing that control. And I mean, that could then cause you to be more like anxious. Exert some more control so that you feel like you're in control, but actually it makes them rebel more. So by including them in those conversations, and actually involving them and giving them that responsibility and that respect, they're more likely to actually fall in line and be
Yeah.
helpful, nice people.
I think it's like who do you want to have as a child? Do you want to have someone who is obedient, or do you want to have someone who's empowered? And the thing is, when we're in that fear state, we're often wanting that obedient child who's never going to like go and do anything scary or risky, right? But actually, an empowered child who feels trusted, just even saying those words, like it's like an empowered child who feels trusted is probably less likely. Well, they might go into some of these scary situations, but they're going to be the ones who call you
Yeah.
when things get tricky because they know that you are the safe harbor.
Yeah, they're not
And
going to
that,
hide that from you. They'll
yeah.
seek your help rather than, try and hide what's happened, what's gone on. I
Yeah.
like that.
And I think the more we try and exert control and obedience, the more we're just encouraging sneakiness and secrecy. And the more our children feel trusted and like a stakeholder in their own lives, the more they are likely to stay close to us. And I think there's this thing, isn't there, of like there's staying close. Because a child actively wants to stay close to their parents, which is the ideal, or they're staying close because the parent is like controlling their lives from
Yeah.
going. And obviously, we want the staying close because they
Because
want
they
to.
want to be.
Yeah.
I've got someone else has asked how do we move them away from being so self-absorbed, and make, well, so these are all separate questions, however, well, separate bullet points from the same person. However, I think that several of these actually tie in really nicely together. Yeah. And that includes how not to be so self-absorbed, how to have a sense of self-worth and stop being so materialistic, and how to exercise, and also be aware of how your behavior impacts on others, understanding respectful life experience the parents have. Now, I think all of those four bullet points tie in with exactly what we were just discussing.
Yeah.
By giving that child more responsibility, by bringing them into those conversations, they're going to realize that actually there's a lot more going on than they're aware of, aren't they? You know, my 7-year-old is now in juniors, and she's been given more responsibility. Now, that was air quoted, guys, if you're not watching. but she's been given more responsibility at school. She's now an art monitor. She's got to be even more aware of where her books are, and I've given her more responsibility at home as well. So now she's in junior, she doesn't get a free snack anymore. She has to take in a snack. And so she does her snack in the morning. She does her water bottle. We do her breakfast together. She gets her clothes ready the night before and gets dressed the next morning. So I've increased the level of responsibility at home. The school have increased the level of responsibility at school. And she is relishing it. She's absolutely loving the fact that she has this responsibility to be, to look after these things and be, you know, if she doesn't have a snack at school, that's her problem. I mean, it's not, I will remind her, but you know, it's her responsibility to choose a healthy snack, put it in her bag. 80% of the time she'll choose an apple over anything else, but she's really relishing this responsibility. And I think that, you know, I have no experience of this, you do, but by giving kids more responsibility within the household as well, that could help, I think, with some of the, you know, concerns over being self-absorbed and not understanding how their behavior impacts others in the house as well. Because I'm guessing it's a situation where it's like, dump my stuff, get a snack, go to my room, isolate myself, snap at everyone, not want to come down for dinner kind of situation. Do you think something like that would
help? I mean, from a brain development perspective, there is a significant empathy reduction between the ages of 13 and 16. And that increases again later in the teenage years.
Yeah. Right?
So the question about the child being self-absorbed, how can I stop them being so self-absorbed? I would say that is a natural developmental stage that children, teenagers, go through. So in a way, how do I stop them being self-absorbed? Well, we kind of can't stop them from being a teenager, because that's just a developmental process. However, I think, you know, there are things that we can do to make sure that that does not continue past, you know, that age of 16. And, you know, we can, but the best way to do that is if we know that our children's empathy is reduced during that time, what can we do? I think the main thing we can do is model empathy. Yeah. Because when you're modeling empathy, you're not forcing anybody to be empathetic. You are simply modeling it. So you're showing the child that this is the way that we act in the world. And I think also that empathy helps with the self-worth piece as well, because it, you know, when we, and I think the thing is, right, with the aware of impacts, teenagers especially, I would say this is true of all children, But teenagers especially are not going to be able to listen to you unless they feel that they have been heard first. So I would say the thing is trying to like sort of shoehorn these things in about like, don't be so self-absorbed, you know, have better self-worth, you know, be aware of the impacts, you know, those things can only happen once the child feels very, very listened to. So really, this is about connection. And this is a tricky thing because we have this idea in Western culture that teenagers become disconnected from their parents. And that is not necessarily true in all cultures that they have that belief. Yes, teenagers definitely need rites of passage. They need separation and return. But if we are viewing the teenage years as a time of disconnection, then we're really starting off on the wrong foot. And it's more about having the belief that actually I need to prioritize connection. But the way that I'm going to prioritize connection is through listening first. And
my mum used to pick me up from school when I remember she'd let me sit in the front and we'd like maybe go for a drive, go a bit, little bit longer on the way home so that we could talk. In another podcast that I did with SPD, tuition coaching and speech therapy with Charlotte, we discussed side by side.
Yeah, that's so important. Yeah.
So actually just, you know, go for a drive, take the long way home, ask them a bit more about their day, listen. And I mean, that 100% worked with me. I still like to go for drives, you know, with my husband, or I take my eldest out for a bit. You know, it's nice just to be like, there's that, you know, there's just the road and you have to concentrate on the road. So therefore they get to talk. And it's quite nice having that element of communication and being able to like sit together and there's no expectation. Like the conversation can just flow. You know, it's definitely helped me when I was a teenager, and I can see why it would help others. But like, it's just so difficult, isn't it? Like even getting them to communicate in things that aren't grunts and moans in the beginning, you know, to start off with is hard. And then also getting them to understand how they fit into the ecosystem of the home as well, and need to be, you know, a productive, helpful person when they really don't want to be. Their brain is pulling against that completely. And then also being like tied to devices as well. You know, you've got mobile phones and tablets and TVs, and even TVs are smart now. So it's a really tricky time to try and get their attention. Yeah. But we've had a couple, well, three people have messaged to say, you know, how do I get them to get off their device? How long is too long? How little is too little?
and I think
it's really hard to find that balance, isn't it?
There's a few things with this. Again, coming back to the brain, really, really important to know about dopamine, because the teenage brain is primed for enhanced dopamine release. And this is why teenagers are drawn to risky behaviors, because you get a dopamine rush from them. And we know as adults that we get a dopamine rush from being on our devices. Scrolling through Instagram gives us that dopamine rush. And for your teenager, that is enhanced and more intense, because their brain is not the same as ours. It's primed for this enhanced dopamine release, which is, you know, reason why the teenage brain, like addiction, can be a thing within the teen years, because the body is seeking this continual dopamine. So with that in mind, I would never tell like a parent what to do, but I would use that as a really key piece of information when you're deciding what to do. And the next question I'd ask is, what else could they be doing? What else could they be doing? Because I think that that is such a powerful question, because if we think about all the things that they might be missing out on by being on a device. Another calculation that I like to do with people is to add up how many hours of screen time their child is having per week, and then times that by 52, which is the number of weeks in a year.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be that a child is, I can't remember the maths on this, but like it can be the equivalent to a month, day and night on a screen, or even like 2 months, day and night on a screen, you know. And another thing to think about is, you know, from having been a secondary school teacher, our children are looking at screens most of the day because they're learning from interactive whiteboards, right? So it's not just, and obviously that's out of our control. We can't do anything about that. And I would really encourage people to tune into what their values are. And is your child's screen time in alignment with your values? And if it's not in alignment with your values, it's going to piss you off.
Yeah.
And it's going to piss you off every day, and it's going to become a source of disconnection between you and your child. So those are the things I'd say. Think about the child's brain development, think about what else they could be doing, and think about your values and whether the screen time that you have in your home fits with those values or goes against those values, and make informed choices based upon those things. Because ultimately, however much your teens want to go on screens, you're the adult.
It is so difficult, isn't it? And unless you've really explored what your values are, you just sort of like, I feel sometimes like as a parent, I'm just on autopilot. I do what I have to do to get by. You're in that sort of like, you know, that state of just existing, aren't you, as well? Like, you know, this last week, my husband's been away and I've got all three kids at home on my own. And so literally it's up in the morning, out the house, do work, get kids, go to have dinner, go to bed, you know. And even then, like once they're asleep, I'm getting their clothes ready for the next day so that I can get them out of the house quickly so that we can do all this stuff. And it's like just living like one day to the next, isn't it? So I think, you know, as parents we sometimes find it difficult to stop and reflect like that, don't we? But it's
that's why my profession,
decisions. Yeah.
That's why my profession as a parent coach exists.
Yeah.
Because it takes people off that treadmill. It takes them from plodding through their lives into being intentional. But it's really hard to be intentional by yourself. And that's why you need like that other person to kind of come in and do it. And obviously, if you've got a co-parent, you can potentially do it, be intentional with them, but then there can be a whole other can of worms going on there, like different values.
But you work with parents as well, like not just one parent.
Yeah, I work with
of the parent. You work with both of them as well, don't you?
Yeah, and that's such a powerful journey, like working with both of the parents together, because they get in alignment, even if they're parenting differently. Like my whole thing is, there's no such thing as a parenting robot. Like there's no one way to parent. It's about parenting from the true authenticity of who you are, for the true authenticity of who your child is. There's no one model of how to do it. It's just what fits in alignment and what helps you to flow.
Finding flow. Who knew? But yeah, no, it's really so tricky to like sit down and take that time when you're tired, and you have to be, as you said, intentional about it and sit down and go, okay. And I think as well, when you may have met your partner, you've sat down, you've dated, you've just decided you want to be together, you decide you want to have kids, you have those sorts of conversations about, oh, I feel like I want them to be like this, or I want to parent like that, or this is going to be my style. And then you realize that things actually, that's not necessarily the case, or your two styles don't gel as well as you'd hope. And you've actually got to sit down and talk about it, because like my husband and I have very different parenting styles, but we both pick each other up on stuff that we don't agree with. And we're like, oh, you know, when you said that, I'm not sure that was the right thing to say. Maybe if we reframe it like this, that will work better. And my eldest has ADHD, and as a part of that has exhibit signs of rejection sensitivity dysphoria as well. So if you're too harsh with her, she just goes into complete meltdown, retreats, that's it, I'm not part of this family, no one loves me, everyone hates me, kind of thing, which is having a teenager basically. But you know, she goes into this self, you know, she pulls everything in and that's it, and trying to get her to open back up again and realize that actually that's not the case, and that we do love her and that she is part of this family, and all of that as well is difficult. But it means that we've had to change the way we are, you know, the way we approach stuff. If she is jumping off the furniture, we'll say, please stop. If she does it again, we'll explain, you know, that's really dangerous, like, could you please, can you not do that? If you want to go and jump on something, there's a trampoline outside, go and jump on the trampoline, you know. Or like, she's inherently risky behavior at all times. Because again, as part of ADHD, she just doesn't have any idea that she could actually like break something or hurt herself. That can be quite scary as well. But it's such a tricky time at any time being a parent. And then, but actually understanding what your child's brain is doing and coming to terms with that, I think really helps as well. Yeah. So from, you know, just thinking, oh my God, my child's, you know, complete and utter risk taker. She, you know, she overreacts and she's very emotional, to, oh, I think she's got ADHD. Finding out that she does have ADHD and then being able to understand her better. And even with my toddler, she wants to make all the decisions but can't. Her brain is, and I was looking at brain scans of between the ages of 2 and 4, and it's just an absolute cluttered mess in that noggin. And you're just like, oh my God, no wonder you can't make a decision. Nothing's in the right place yet. And I mean, when you put it in the way of like, their brains aren't even developed properly until the age of 25, how can you work with that? It's really tricky. And you know, like with my eldest, I've given her more responsibility. She likes having the responsibility. She feels like she's achieving something and doing something good. My 3-year-old now likes to be helpful around the house. And so she, you know, she'll, oh, Indy, it would be really helpful if you could go and grab me that tea towel. Could you do that for me? Yes. Off she goes and does it. She likes being helpful. And I think, you know, as we've discussed, those are all the sorts of things that we need to be doing with our teenagers as well. Showing them a level of trust, getting them involved in the house and giving them responsibility so that they actually feel like they're part of the family and that they've got that connection with you, and listening.
And I think, you know, it's interesting what you brought up there, because the two times in a child's life where there's like a real spike in brain development are the toddler years and the teenage years. So there's a correlation there. And I think what you said there about, like, you mentioned risk taking, and that's something that I've mentioned before in this conversation, but I think it's so important for teenagers to find spaces for healthy risk taking. And there's some really interesting research about how teenage boys, especially, who are on computer, like video games, a lot, it's because they're trying to meet that need for healthy risk taking and rites of passage in a world that doesn't really cater or provide opportunity for teenage boys to have healthy risk and rites of passage. And you look at more indigenous cultures and the kind of rites of passage things that they go through, and sometimes, you know, they're crazy dangerous things that teenagers need to do, like and obviously we don't necessarily want our teenagers doing crazy dangerous things, but there can be this thing where if a teenager doesn't have those experiences to do that healthy risk taking, that separating and returning, it can end up being that they can get stuck in like a enduring adolescence because they didn't get that passage into adulthood that comes from taking healthy risks. And the problem is children are going to seek those healthy risks in ways which are potentially not very healthy unless we are providing opportunity for them to do so.
Yeah. So I remember feeling very, you know, trusted, you know, just even being able to go to the park on my own for the first time,
yeah,
like that. And it's, I think, you know, we're very much more aware of like the risks of the world, aren't we, around us. And I think that again makes it like, oh no, you can't go to the park with your friends until you're much older now. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, you know, I remember being able to go to the park when I was, you know, in year six.
Yeah.
not having to wait until like I was 13 or whatever. But it's really tricky. And also the way they isolate themselves as well, you know, like we've spoken about, you know, grabbing a snack, giving a grunt, going to their bedroom kind of thing. But also like withdrawing from like all the clubs and the things that they used to enjoy, seeing your child retreat like that, I think can be quite nerve-wracking as well. Like one person's message to say, my daughter's dropped all sports clubs and dance classes. She just wants to sit at home on a device or the television, no interest in much else, should I be worried? And that, again, it's a really tricky one, isn't it? Like,
because in one way it's quite normal, in another way it's not optimal.
Yeah. Like,
because, you know, teenagers are humans and all of those things, the kind of healthy sports and stuff like that, those are important for mental well-being, and sitting at home not doing much on screen is not so optimal for mental well-being. And yet, you know, with all of this crazy brain development that's happening, it's exhausting. And, you know, sleep is a big issue in the teenage years as well. And I think probably the main thing that a parent can do with that withdrawing is creating opportunities to return to connection, and constantly having that as a question in your mind. How can I make steps to, when your child is withdrawing, whatever age they are, how can I make steps to reconnect? And that reconnecting might look different to when they're little. It might be, like you said, going on a car drive with them. It might be, you know, kind of entering into their world without judgment.
Yeah.
And doing some of the things that they like doing, even if you think they're daft, you know. And just whenever the child, whatever age they are withdrawing, remembering that the antidote to nearly everything is always connection. And I think it starts from that turning up the AC, and this time, rather than curiosity, it's acceptance and connection, turning up the AC.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, like...
One-on-one time, sorry. I think that that's a big important part, that especially if they've got siblings, is having that one-on-one time where it's like dates together. I think that's so important, like going out to a coffee shop that they like going to and having dates together.
Yeah, or even just taking the dog for a walk together, getting out, moving as well. I think it's quite important, you know, I used to love going for walks with my family. We'd go down to the River Lea and walk down the towpath. and we could talk about anything, and we took it in turns as well. So it'd be like, you know, even though my sister and my stepdad were there, it might be that I walked with him for a bit and then walked with my mum for a bit, and we'd have those separate conversations where we could spend that time together and, you know, be out in the open and smell the fresh air. And, you know, it's really, I feel like that is such an important thing as well. Or even like you said, spending time doing an activity that they really enjoy, you know, even if that is sitting there and playing a Mario Kart for a bit together. Yeah.
and I think it's that commitment, right? Even if your teenager's like, oh, I don't want to do that with you, relentlessly keeping on going and not forcing them to do stuff, but offering the connection all the time, offering the connection. And because then even if the child doesn't want to accept it, they know that it's there. And that is so important. Like, what we want to avoid so much in those teenage years is things becoming disconnected, because when disconnection happens, humans are hardwired to seek attachment. And if the attachment's not there at home, then they will seek that attachment through their friends. And all of the scarier things in the teenage years, they're more vulnerable to if the centre of that attachment is their peers rather than their parents.
So, as you said, you know, making sure they always know that that connection is there and available to them. It's just, it's that reliability, isn't it? It's all like reliably knowing that your parent is there. If you need to speak to them, you can. Even if you don't want to right now, you can later on. I think it's funny, isn't it? Like, I just feel like I was given a level of trust when I was a teenager to do certain things and behave in a certain way. And for a while, it was cool. I was doing that. And it was when that trust started to disappear and things got a little bit more at home, that I started to take more risks and rebel. And I can remember those years really well. You know, they're sort of like glued in my brain. They were the years where I felt like, at first I was given the responsibility, I had a bus pass, I could go to college, and then I got a boyfriend, and then it all sort of went a bit more downhill from there. The level of trust you know, started to get withdrawn, and I was, you know, grounded and things, and that made me want to try and sneak out and see my friends. And the idea of missing out really affected me, and I hated it. I wanted to be there, I wanted to be with them. And so I can relate completely with that. And you know, that the minute I got my bus pass and I was, you know, oh yeah, you can go to college on your own, and you know, you come back by this time for tea, and as long as you're home, it's cool. And I was, you know, well on track, you know. And then I had my mobile phone. If anything, I just called my mum or sent her a text and said, you know, I'm going to be a bit late or whatever. But it was as I moved into those higher teenage years and got myself a boyfriend, that level of trust sort of just went. And it became really difficult.
I think it takes so much courage and inner work and grappling with fear and trusting in yourself and trusting in your child in order to, as a parent, be that safe, sturdy base from which your children can flourish. And that is like that's like a hero's journey, like doing that. You know, and I think that parents, you know, that is potentially going to be tricky, and I would really urge parents to seek support during that time, whether that be support from a coach or a therapist, or it's like a support within their friends, their friendship groups, like solidarity. But it's not just that the teenager's changing, the parent is having to grow an awful lot in response to that. So it's really two people growing together. And, you know, the word growing pains, like, you know, it's a process. And one of the things I always say is that parenting is leadership.
Yeah.
And parenting is benevolent leadership. And I think those teenage years are a big test of that benevolent leadership, but also, you know, looking at it in a really expansive, optimistic way, like a real chance for that leadership to flourish. Like, we don't always need to be looking at things from like, oh, this is scary and bad. Like, it's like, how can I use these teenage years with the challenges that might come as an opportunity to rise and grow in benevolent leadership?
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really feel like we've learned a lot and we've discussed a lot and, you know, really traversed the idea of actually having to grow and let go, which is really difficult, I think, for everyone. But honestly, it's been a fantastic conversation. I really hope that our listeners have, you know, got their, one, got their answers, and two, felt like they're able to sort of like approach things maybe a bit differently, or, you know, you might actually be doing, you know, everything right. It's just waiting to see the fruits of that as well. It's a really tough one. waiting for that cake to bake can be a bit difficult.
I think that's a wonderful way of putting it, waiting for the cake to bake, and I'm knowing that the cake won't be ready until 25-ish.
That's amazing. So Emily, if someone has listened to this today and feels like they need that help and support from a coach like yourself, how can they reach out? How can they find you?
So you can go to my website, which will probably be listed on this, but it's www.findingflowparenting.coach. You can follow me on Instagram. It's pretty much the only social media I invest my time in. I am on other ones, but that one I invest my time in. And yeah, I do workshops, I do group coaching, and I do one-to-one and couples coaching as well, where the couple comes to see me to talk about their parenting. So yeah, great. Thank you so much.
And I look forward to speaking to you again very soon. If you enjoyed this episode of Mum's Work in Chaos, please make sure to subscribe on whatever podcasting channel you're listening on at the moment. Or if you'd like to get involved, feel free to email me at mumsworkandchaos@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram @mumsworkandchaos. See you then.